G'day everybody, my name is Glenn Hill.
And I'm Jacob Meyer.
And welcome to another Tactical Tennis Podcast episode. And Jake, you're not at home right now, are you?
No, if you've got a little bit of background noise that you're not used to, it's because I'm out in the media garden at the US Open.
Yeah, so if you get interrupted by people coming up to say hello, listeners, just bear with us, and likewise with the crowd noise and people around. So today, I don't know if you got a chance to watch any of the Kyrgios-Federer match, Jake. I think you didn't, if I remember correctly, right? You were working with other people at the time.
That's right. I was with a player, so unfortunately I wasn't able to watch it.
Well, it had some stretches of some of the most entertaining tennis. It might have had the single most entertaining one game that I've ever seen that included the around-the-net shot from Federer yesterday, but to me, it was a match that really highlighted the highs and lows of the person that we wanted to talk about today, which is Nick Kyrgios.
Yeah, he's really an interesting... I mean, he's a person, so I shouldn't say he's an interesting character. But what I mean by that is there's a character study that I think that we can look at him, and there's a lot of really useful stuff I think that we can kind of dive into tennis and learn more about.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's probably the most galvanizing player in professional tennis right now, because people either absolutely love him or seem to absolutely loathe him, and the dialogue around Kyrgios is very polarized, for want of a better way to put it.
Yeah, you gotta really be proud of Australia stepping up and producing both Hewitt and Kyrgios. The whole love-hate relationship is pretty cool.
One of the things I think we wanted to do today is talk a little bit about Kyrgios' game, and also put some of his results over the line and his kind of career arc in some context. So I don't know, where do you want to kick things off?
Well, man, that's an interesting one. I think we should make clear that, well, let's go with this latest result, right? Kyrgios loses to Federer in three sets. And in some sense, the fact that this is a straight sets win for Federer had to be surprising to a lot of people.
I think certainly the lack of a tiebreaker was surprising to a lot of people, because every time these guys have played before, there's been at least one tiebreaker involved, and they have a history of going to breakers. So that, I think, was definitely surprising.
Yeah, and their matches have been super, super close. Kyrgios has won some of them. You know, he's had really good results, basically, against guys that win slams, I think is what it is. It seems like he gets really... really motivated to play what he looks at as the big matches, which is any time that he gets a chance to play the more venerable characters in the game.
Absolutely. And there's a very noticeable difference in his engagement level when those opportunities do come up. And this is also, I think, part of this narrative that people have about him being somebody who quits all the time, and how he doesn't respect his opponents, he doesn't respect the game, he doesn't respect the fans. But I think that maybe we should back up a little bit and talk about some of his junior results, and then kind of his career arc into professional tennis, and maybe a little bit about some of the injuries and how all this stuff ties together.
All right. So if we back up there, let's go to junior tennis. What stands out to him? What stands out to you about Nick Kyrgios as a junior?
I mean, to be honest with you, the single biggest thing that stood out to me when I looked at some footage of him playing as a younger player, you know, kind of 14 years old, was that he was very overweight for a tennis player, especially a tennis player playing at a high level.
Okay, so he was an overweight junior, especially when he was younger. I mean, 14 is really young, right? So,
oh, absolutely.
We're not saying this to be critical, right?
No, if anything... I think it speaks well of him, the fact that he was overweight playing high-level tennis at 14, and he buckled down and obviously did something, changed something, which isn't ever easy to do, and nobody would ever call him overweight now, that's for sure.
What kind of results did he have as a junior? I mean, was this guy, did he come out of nowhere? Was he completely off the radar for people, or has he been a prodigious talent? I mean, did he win multiple slams like some of these players do?
Okay, so, you know, he definitely didn't come out of nowhere as a junior. He won the boys singles at the 2013 Australian Open, And then also the boys' doubles at the 2013 Wimbledon Championships. He turned professional after that and made the quarters of 2014 Wimbledon main draw. That was the year that he beat Rafael Nadal there, and then also Gasquet.
Especially, I mean, I'm in kind of a unique situation because I'm pretty close to a lot of the Australian coaches and a lot of people that were involved with Tennis Australia during that time, back then, right? Not so much now, but during that time. And in Australia, which of course, let me reiterate, is very isolated. You know this because you're Australian. But for the rest of us, we forget it's very hard to get to Australia. It's very isolated.
It's so, very expensive and it takes a very long time.
Yeah, it's really tough. And it's hard for juniors to get out of the country and get the same quantity of results that, say, European players can. European players have access to far, far more tournaments overall and a far better quality of tournament, generally speaking.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you're a 13-year-old growing up in Europe, you can jump from one country to the other sometimes in a 30-minute car ride and be playing international tennis. Whereas in Australia, I mean, realistically, and this is no disrespect intended to like Indonesia, Malaysia, and Fiji, and the other countries that are closest to Australia geographically.
Those countries are not as good. I mean, even Japan is not as good at tennis as, generally speaking, the European countries are.
No, absolutely. That's what I'm saying. Like, to as a junior growing up in Australia, to go and play any of the big, really tough tournaments against other international players, you have to be on a plane for at least 13 or 14 hours.
Yeah, yeah, and that's tough. And I didn't realize this until I started going over to Australia as a regular part of my job. I thought, like, well, Australia, I mean, you can just go to Japan. Like, Japan's close. It's 9 hours. And that's if you're going directly from the major city to the major city. Forget about if, I mean, you might fly 4 hours across Australia as well in order to get your 9-hour flight just to get to Japan. And that's not even getting into the other parts of Asia. So you're really, really, they're limited there. The reason this is important is because sometimes Australians can kind of fly under the radar.
Yes, but true.
And sometimes I think that they're not necessarily ranked accurately as juniors.
Right. But, I mean, in Nick's case, he did get international travel. I mean, obviously, he had those great results at some of the junior Grand Slam championships. And then once he hit the Pro Tour, I mean, he very quickly made his mark. I mean, you're talking about in the space of, 7 months, he's turned professional, made the quarters at Wimbledon and the quarters at the Australian Open in his home slam in very short order.
Yeah, and that's something that also stands out to me that I don't think people talk about a lot. Winning in Australia at your home slam is something that's very hard for Australians to do.
Yes.
Right? Like, this is also true for the French. Very few Frenchmen win the French Open, juniors or in the Open, right? So It's like, it's a little bewildering to me when Kyrgios won the junior Aussie that people didn't give him more credit to say, wow, like, this guy had a ton of pressure on him marching through this tournament, and he really held up well in circumstances where talented junior after talented junior after talented junior have fallen short for Australia. Because there's been a lot of kids coming through that have been very, very good in juniors that have not quite made it as pros. And that's just, that one always struck me as a little bit weird. It's like, I feel like sometimes the media in Australia was a little bit, and I say this very loosely because, of course, there's lots of media in Australia, but somehow the culture seemed to be a little bit tough on him, even at that point where it was like, if you fail, we're going to give you a hard time. But when you win, you know, we celebrate you a little, but we don't really make that big of a deal out of it. Where I feel like in the U.S., there's a little bit more like, you know, we have a young junior gets to number one in the ITF rankings, and all of a sudden he's going to be the next Pete Sampras or the next Roger Federer. And it's like, no, dude, like, that guy's not even top 100 in the men's, like, rankings yet. And he might never get there. Let's not celebrate him like he's Pete Sampras. That's not good. Well, that's not good for him.
One thing I will say, though, is that there's a lot less focus on the Australian Open Junior Championships in Australia But we actually have a pretty good history in the last 10 years or so. So here's my list of Australians who have won the Australian Open Junior Championships. You've got the infamous Bryden Klein, whose name you've probably never heard of before, or maybe you have. Bernard Tomic the following year in 2008. Yep. Luke Seville won it 2012, then Kyrgios in 2013, and then Oliver Anderson won it in 2016. So it's certainly not a thing that doesn't happen, so to speak.
On the contrary, I think that there's been tremendous young talent that's come out of Australia over the last 15 years especially. And, I mean, those guys are all also tennis players. It's just like, hey, one of these guys was able to both win and transition that into the pros within the first 18 months.
Right, now that is certainly impressive.
I mean that's crazy in a sense. Like, we don't expect American juniors to win the U.S. Open and 18 months later to be top 30 in the world. Like, that's
not... Well, to win the junior U.S. Open, just
well,
to be clear.
Yes, yeah. To win the junior U.S. Open and then to be top 30 in the ATP rankings. I mean, we don't really expect that. And we kind of have started to tell people, like, hey, that's not really the way it works in this day and age of Federer and Nadal.
Yeah, but I don't think anybody really expects that kind of a transition. But let's talk a little bit about Kyrgios' game and why he was able to make that transition. I think any conversation about his game has to start with the serve, because it is one of the greatest serves in the history of tennis.
In some ways, I mean, I would be comfortable saying he can do more with his serve than anyone else ever has been able to.
I don't know that I quite agree with that, but
what?
Well, but you're welcome. You're welcome to make the argument.
Okay. Well, he can hit into the 140s. Okay. I mean, his serve's huge. It's so fast, and he comfortably can go in the high 130s all the time. Now, even right, he's been able to hit that big since he was 17 years old. So when he's 17, and he first starts out on the pro tour. Like, one of my players played against him just a few weeks before he played Rafa. And he was hitting that big. I mean, he was hitting massive.
Sure.
Like, he didn't magically, like, drink some Gatorade or something, and then now he went from serving 120 to serving 135 when he was playing Rafa at Wimbledon. Like, he had an absolute laser of a serve for a long time. On top of that, I mean, I've seen this guy hit kick serves that are, I think, almost 130 miles an hour. I really haven't seen anyone that has the same rotation, like the same RPMs on the ball at that speed and can put it in the box.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's really the
consistency.
That's I think, the one of the big things there is that being able to put it at that speed with those kind of RPMs. I mean, I think you could make a case maybe Raonic could do a similar kind of quality. I mean, I certainly think that in terms of, stretches, going back a couple of years before he got injured, I mean, Raonic's serve there for a while was hands down the greatest actual serve that we've ever seen in tennis. But I think, Kyrgios is very close behind. I mean, just to be clear, I want to clarify something here too when I talk about this. Like, you know, obviously nobody wants to face John Isner's serve or Ivo Karlovic's serve, but in terms of actual motions, I mean, those guys, if you shrunk them down to 6'4", they're
not that great.
They're nowhere near the caliber that they are. I mean, if you put them at 6'4", 6'5", you put them at the heights of, you know, like your Kyrgios's and your Raonic's, they're not even in the same conversation in terms of quality of serve, just based on the technique. I mean, they are that good purely because they are that tall. Whereas, you know, if you cut 4 or 5 inches off and all of a sudden the net looks a lot higher, things change. Just something that I think is important to put in context when we talk about this, because, you know, sure, you could go and look at the numbers and say, well, you know, Karlovic holds more often or Isner hits more aces than so-and-so.
Well, but that's interesting, because Craig O'Shanty's, he's, you know, kind of the data numbers guy that is also publishing stuff out there. And he's putting out more and more stuff saying that by the numbers, Kyrgios might have the best serve that we've seen. Now, I'm with you on this. I think when Milos Raonic was serving well and playing well, and when he was number 3 in the world, I wasn't sure anything was going to stop him. It seemed to me like he had a better serve. He had great control over spots with his kicker, great control over spots with his quote-unquote slider that was like 125, mm-hmm. and he could also go 140. So, I mean, he was pumping serves. And Milos is very professional in his approach to the game and in his preparation, and he's in the gym, et cetera, et cetera. But when I look at Kyrgios' serve, what I see is that he can hit all these different spins and rotations, and just that he's capable of doing almost anything with it. Not that he actually makes the best choices and is the most disciplined and has the best outcome.
Right. Well, I will also say this, though. I mean, he's one of only three players in tennis history to have beaten Fed, Rafa, and Djokovic on the first time that he played them. And, I mean, the other two were Hewitt and Hribadi, and both of them played those guys when they were very, very early in their career before they'd really kind of reached their peak right. levels. Whereas Kyrgios came in and beat all three of them on
best.
His first try when they were really at their best or near their best. And so he didn't do that just on serving alone, although obviously the serve is a big part of that. He also has a very big forehand that certainly ranks up there amongst the biggest on the tour, although it's not without its issues.
Well, the word on the street, as we would say, the guys on the tour would say that Kyrgios probably has the biggest forehand. It's him and probably Jack Sock. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not necessarily the best, but if you're just talking about pumping the ball as hard as you can, everyone feels like Nick can do that the most.
Well, Del Potro has to be in that conversation, surely.
So there's this difference between Del Potro's forehand and Kyrgios's forehand, where Del Potro's forehand seemingly comes in very flat. I mean, this is how guys on the tour feel, right? Like, you and I understand Del Potro's forehand has a lot of topspin on it. He's not hitting a forehand 100 miles an hour and keeping the ball in the court without topspin.
Sure. Right? I mean, it has to have some, right?
Yeah. But. Well, and it actually has pretty good, but the ball travels very linearly. So it's traveling flat, which isn't the same thing to say as it doesn't have spin on it. But Kyrgios's ball definitely has more spin, and it has shape to it and still has the same velocity. So the sense that guys have, right, that if you just walk around and talk to, say, like 30 or 40 players that are outside of the top 20 in the world and inside of the top 200, they feel like, man, I played Kyrgios one time and his forehand had more RPMs than my serve.
Right.
That's how it feels, okay?
Sure.
Now, if we do the numbers, I'm sure lots of guys can serve with more RPMs than Nick's forehand. And I'm sure also that Nick can actually hit more RPMs on his forehand than a lot of guys can serve, which is like a little bit scary, right? But definitely what's clear is if you're hanging balls in the middle of the court and you give Kyrgios time to step around that backhand and to hit the inside-out forehand and just kind of unload on the ball, he has seemingly limitless power there.
Right. So that brings up an interesting segue into the backhand, which is a little bit of a unique shot. I mean, he doesn't hit it the way that most other top professional men players hit their two-handed backhands.
Man, yeah, I don't know. I mean, how should we even start talking about this one?
Well, I would say that it certainly seems a lot of the time when he hits that backhand as though he's not even taking a full swing at the ball. It's a very hippie stroke, as in there's not a lot of arm movement. Relatively speaking, a lot of times it's almost like he just kind of just spins his hips and just pushes his hands through a little bit.
Yeah.
And he does a lot of backhands where he just kind of guides the ball back into the court, although he certainly is capable of unloading on that side too when he wants to.
Yeah, I mean, we've coached against him in doubles, and we've coached against him in singles. And you really have to prepare for, hey, this guy's backhand is way better than it looks at first.
Yes.
When you practice with him, or if you watch him practice, you'll see he can just seemingly out of nowhere lean forward a little bit or step into a ball just a hair, and he can hit a backhand down the line 90 miles an hour just like it's out of the blue. Like, and off of a dead ball. Like, it doesn't need to be in a perfect place. So it really stands out because it seems like it's a very, very small swing. It seems like a very short backstroke, backswing in particular.
Right. And so from a technique standpoint, usually we see lots of power from the guys who have bigger windups and longer stroke paths where we get a lot more time to accelerate the racket. And I think this is one of the interesting things about Nick, which is part of the reason why people tend to be so judgmental on him, is that he is able to be so explosive. And yet I think that that explosiveness comes at a price for him because of his lack of preparation.
Yeah. And I mean, you know how I feel about this. Like, we've touched on this a little bit already, right? I mean, when this guy was 16, 17 years old, he was already serving arguably as big or bigger than anyone in the world. And you go back to just what you said, like when he was 13, 14 years old, and he was kind of a chubby kid, right? Like he wasn't the most powerful guy, and he wasn't even the fittest guy. And so if you compare him to someone like look at Miloš Raonic, right? Miloš looks like he carved his legs out of a tree trunk. I mean, the guy
well,
is
a
solid
little,
muscle.
A little less now since his injury. He definitely did not
sure,
come back
yeah.
from injury in shape, but maybe...
So what's interesting is he has this little belly now, but his legs are still extremely strong.
Sure, right? Sure. Well, I think another great example that you brought up earlier when we were chatting was Zverev.
Yeah, I mean, Zverev made a great move, one of the best moves in tennis, I think, when he was... I think he was 16 years old, and we've mentioned this on the podcast before. He hired Jez Green, who is one of the best strength coaches that you can find. He's famous for a lot of people because he also was the strength coach who really built the platform from which Andy Murray ascended to number one in the world. And when he left Andy Murray, he went to work with Sasha Zverev. And I think a lot of people were like, oh my gosh, you're leaving Andy Murray. You know, he's this great guy, and like, where are you going? And I think he saw a 16-year-old Zverev and said, you know, this guy's going to deadlift all the time. He's going to do all my workouts, and he's going to be an absolute beast. And so now he's, what, 19, 20 years old? 20 years old,
now.
And the guy is already deadlifting over 400 pounds. He's like 6'6", 6'7". Like, he's a completely different physical specimen than anyone else his age.
So let's ask the question then. Can Nick Kyrgios deadlift 400 pounds?
Not even close.
Let me rephrase that maybe. Could Nick Kyrgios deadlift 400 pounds without seriously injuring himself?
Right, exactly. Like, I actually would not doubt anything that this guy puts his mind to. if he decided he wanted to try and pick up 400 pounds, he probably could, but the problem is he wouldn't be able to play tennis afterwards, right? He would
right.
really damage.
Maybe not for
really
even 6 months. I mean, yeah, he could really genuinely hurt himself.
Yeah,
in
it'd
the
be
process.
Really a problem.
And that's because when it comes down to it, at the end of the day, he hasn't been doing that kind of work. Like, coming back to the explosiveness question, you know, Zverev has done the preparation physically to be able to go out and handle the rigors of modern tennis and not be constantly injured.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas Kyrgios is more explosive than Zverev, and yet has done less preparation. So he's putting a lot more force on his joints and his muscles, and doing it in a shorter time frame in terms of the power output in like a forehand or a serve. And yet he's done less to prepare his body to be able to handle all those forces.
That's exactly right. And that's, you know, when you think, people just think like, oh, well, he can serve real big when he's young, he's so lucky. What they don't look at is there was only 2 years between being a little bit chubby. He must have worked. I mean, how hard did this guy work to go from being a chubby 14-year-old to being a fit one of the top juniors in the world 2 years later?
Right.
Like, there are stories, if you talk to the old Australian coaches about him working, his work ethic was insanely good, okay? They were like, this guy's going to be unbelievable because he just willed himself to be one of the fitter guys. And then all of a sudden, like, he's just absolutely unloading on the ball. He always had a live arm, but you go from having a live arm to, oh my gosh, like, you're serving harder than the men. You're 17 years old.
Right.
That's really rare. Like, we don't see that very often. the other side of that coin is he's putting force through his body in a way that it's not really, I mean, I don't know a better way to say it, but it's not capable of handling it yet. Like, it's really not meant for that, and it's too much. And I don't think that we should be doing that to our young people in that way.
The thing is, at the end of the day, if you're going to be that explosive, you have to do the work. Like, if you've got to go out and play, I mean, one thing, if, you know, if he was playing a tournament every 3 or 4 weeks and giving his body time to heal and rest and getting proper treatment and doing recovery. But, I mean, the same thing that's stopping him from doing the work to be prepared to play week after week is stopping him from doing that kind of work as well.
Yeah, it's really tough. At this point, he's in a pretty gnarly cycle. It's a tough spot that he's in, because you can contrast, just look at his playing schedule over the last 3 years, right? And let's compare him to Zverev. Zverev almost never has to miss tournaments, and he almost never has to miss practice.
So
he's just training all the time. Like, if he misses a tournament, it's because he won the tournament the week before and he wants to miss the tournament, right? Everyone schedules a couple of extra tournaments just in case they lose in the first round or, you know, whatever the thinking is. But basically, that's a normal thing on the tour. But when we look at Nick, he doesn't have that kind of consistency in training, and he doesn't have that kind of consistency in tournaments. And it seems like, from the outside, right, this is me speaking as like a strength and conditioning coach, which is really where I started in tennis years ago. That kind of thing has long, long history and long roots to it. It doesn't come up out of the blue. So,
sure.
You know, Nick's quote-unquote struggles, because people want him to be a top five player. They want him at least to be a top 10 player. And so when he's not a top 10 player, when he's not a top 15 player, then we look at him and we think, well, he's struggling. So those
right.
perceived struggles have long roots into his history and his development. And he's in a real difficult place right now, where he's not physically capable of the tennis that he can play on one day. So like, if he goes out and plays Djokovic next week, he can play like maybe the best player in the world. But if you ask him to do that the next day, and the next day, and the next day, then basically he's going to have probably extreme pain. That's what I would
right.
expect.
Like, well, it's just, but we see that. We see that all the time. I mean, he withdraws a relatively large amount. He's in a lot of matches where he's obviously hurt. And this is one of the things that I think really I find interesting, is that to a lot of casual fans, they watch, and maybe even some not so casual fans, I mean, they watch Kyrgios play, and the narrative that I hear a lot is, well, if Nick would just try hard, he would be the best player in the world. But it's really not that simple, is it?
No, I think there's a sense in which, like, Nick treats people on the tour well. Like, if you ask any of the players, they'll say, oh, he's a great guy. Because he treats everyone well. He treats his family well. He treats the people around him well. We see the worst of him when he's in a match and he's injured and he's losing. That's the worst Nick Kyrgios that I've ever even heard of, right? Like, we don't hear of him behaving worse than that in his personal life. And so it's more than a little frustrating for us when we look, if you look at him just as a regular person, as another player, just like any of the other players, then it's a gross understatement to just say, well, if the guy would just try harder, then he would be ranked higher. These guys are trying really, really as hard as they can. That's not going to be the issue. I mean, he's playing matches where there's millions of dollars on the line all the time. And even if you don't like him, if you think that he doesn't want the millions of dollars, if you think that he doesn't want the extra attention, if you think that he doesn't want to be able to buy a house for his mom, then you have to question, I mean, are you really taking that question even seriously?
To me, when people talk about, well, and I, you know, obviously Nick's fueled this fire himself with some of his comments where he talks about not really liking tennis very much. But one of the things that I find interesting is, I mean, he's made plenty of money already. And as hurt as he always seems to be, you know, why wouldn't he just take 6 months off and get better? And I think part of it to me is, I watching him play against Federer yesterday, and the look on his face when Fed hit that ball around the net post was just joy. I mean, he looked so happy just to have been out on that court and seen that shot hit. there's a part where he obviously clearly does love the game and clearly does love the experience of being a professional tennis player. And I think there's also a way in which he hasn't learned yet or gained a specific type of maturity of how to handle himself with some of his press interviews and whatnot. And that's certainly helped, I think, give the impression that this is a guy who hates tennis and doesn't want to be out there. And when you combine that with some of the struggles that he has, where he's obviously, sometimes I think he's out there and not trying very hard because he's hurting.
You say he's not trying very hard because he's hurting, but I think that that misses it a little bit too. That misses it. Like, that's not...
Well, sometimes. I said sometimes he is.
So tell me how this sounds to you. I don't want this to sound like I'm making excuses for him, because he needs to prepare better, and I think he should. I think he would be happier. I mean, I think generally in life he's a happy guy, but I think he would be happier just as a person if he reprioritized things a little bit. So if he's healthier, it's easier to be in a good mood. It's easier to be happier, right? If you're in a good mood, it's easier to be happier. If your body feels good, and if you're not stressed out and you're not in pain, it's easier to be the person that you want to be. So this isn't really specific to Kyrgios, right? It's just general advice for anyone. Be as healthy as you can, and life is easier, right? You have to understand that realistically, that's a luxury to prioritize your health and feeling good. So now that Nick has sacrificed his body and he's made some money, now he has, to some degree, an opportunity to prioritize, okay, I'm going to get healthy and I'm really going to get strong enough to do what I enjoy doing and to do it the way I want to do it. And that's where I think things get a little bit tricky for him. But the thing that I want people to understand is, if you're in pain and you're injured, and if you try to push off and change direction, or if you try to serve hard and your arm hurts, or if you try to run around a backhand and your legs just don't move, then it's not that you're not trying hard because you're hurt. It's that you're trying hard and you hurt, so you're just not that good. If the pain is a result of a lack of function, then the problem is that you're just not as good as we are used to seeing you. And so it looks like, well, he's not doing what he did 6 months ago. He must not be trying hard. But,
right.
I mean, you got to understand, this guy would play someone like 25 or 30 in the world and toy with them. Like, he would just fool around and beat somebody in straights. Like, he wasn't having to play disciplined. He wasn't having to be a robot and a boring guy to watch. He was literally goofing around and was just that much better than everyone. If he's not doing that, you've really got to ask yourself seriously, well, what would stop him from doing that? Why doesn't he just go back to toying around and beating the crap out of most of the tour? And to me, the only possible reason that he wouldn't is because he can't. He's not holding that back. Like, I mean, there are a few things that are more fun than just being like, yeah, I'm just going to win this one easy.
Right. No, that's a good place to be in. You made the point earlier when we were chatting before we started recording today, where if you just look at the number of backhands Kyrgios hits per match now compared to where it was a couple of years ago, he just doesn't move as well. He doesn't have the ability to run around backhands as often and hit as many forehands and be as much in control when he's not, you know, following up on his big serve. So, you know, I think there's some pretty clear evidence of some of the lack of function that you talked about.
Yeah, there's a lot there. Sometimes when we see him he'll hit second serves like 135 instead of hitting his kicker, then you got to wonder, well, I mean, he used to ace people with the kicker. Maybe when he says, well, my elbow's bothering me, maybe he's not lying, right? Maybe he's just telling us the truth. Maybe it really does bother him, and we see him using something different that maybe, you know, we want to judge him and say, hey, that's not a smart play, but maybe he's just using the best thing he has.
Right. Well, also, I think a lot of the times there's that part where he doesn't say, oh, my elbow hurts, or oh, my shoulder hurts, or oh, this hurts. He just goes out and plays, and when he does stuff like that, it's easy to be like, well, he's not trying hard, or he's just throwing that point away, where maybe...
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good point, and it's something that's worth pointing out. Like, in my experience of all players that I've ever worked with, of everyone, players at that level, when they're winning, they don't want to tell you if something hurts. Like, if you think that the first time he said to the press, hey, my arm's hurting me, if you think that's the first time it actually hurt, I think you're crazy.
Sure.
Because I'm sure that it was bothering him before he ever told the press, before he told his best friend, before he told anyone on his team, before he told his mother. Because, I mean, it's the same thing that you have, right? Like, if you have a little ache or a little pain, the first thing you do, you notice it, and then you wait and you see, well, does it come back tomorrow? Does it happen if I do this, or does it happen if I do that? You try and figure out what's going on. You don't just go and start talking to people about it. He's had this stuff, I think, probably since he broke through on the tour. And, you know, we just act like everyone is supposed to be Roger Federer and have 25 years of largely healthy tennis. And that's not the case. You know, I mean, you know this about me. I look at Federer and I think this guy over the course of his career has had the best technique of any player of all time. And I think that that's directly related to his longevity. With Nick, I mean, Kyrgios can do things that Federer cannot do. Kyrgios can do things that very few people have ever been able to do. But I think he has to pay the price with his body in order to do them the way that he does them.
Sure.
Because there's
elements in his technique that certainly aren't ideal for the way that he goes about doing it.
Well, he's more explosive than Federer, but you know what? Federer is slower now than he was 10 years ago, but he hasn't had a drop off as fast as Nick. When Nick first came onto the tour, this guy was running around every forehand that Jack Sock and Rafael Nadal hit. Like, you could not get to Nick's backhand, even though his backhand's pretty good, because he would just hit a forehand from anywhere on the court. Now, I mean, I didn't watch him, but, like, was Federer able to get to Nick's backhand last night?
Oh, repeatedly. You know, I mean, it was very obvious that his inability to be able to run around it consistently. You know, I mean, it was...
If you think Nick wants to hit three or four backhands in a point, you're crazy.
No, of course not. Of course not. I mean, a lot of this ties back into a previous podcast about serving strategies and your serve plus one and how you begin the point and playing to your strengths. I mean, yeah, there's no way that he wants to do that.
Oh. But and when he was beating people, it was virtually impossible to make him hit a backhand after the serve.
Right. No, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, you just didn't do it. I've watched him play whole sets where he didn't have to hit a single backhand after the serve. And it's like, well, I mean, you're not going to beat this guy if he's just hitting serves and hitting forehands from anywhere. Really, but especially from the middle of the court. So, you know, I mean, this is the thing to me, and this is what's really interesting. Like, I think instead of listening to what they say, I think instead of listening to what Nick Kyrgios says in a press conference, which, I mean, I like to listen to him. He's a fun guy, and he says some interesting things, and he always gives a very honest, straightforward opinion, and he tells us what he thinks. So for me, that's fun. I like to hear that. But mm-hmm. I'm not just going to listen to what he says in order to make judgments about his tennis. Right?
Oh, you can make the judgments based on the way that he plays the tennis.
I'm going to make the judgments based on the film. We're going to analyze what he's doing and what he's not doing. We're going to look over a large period of time, and we're not going to take emotional outbursts like they're supposed to be gospel. This is just common sense, you know, and this is what we would do with most players.
Right.
So I don't think he should be any different. I don't think he should be treated any differently in that way. We don't have to listen to everything that he says as if it's all 100% accurate. Any more than, you know, some players who come off the court and say, oh, I played really bad against Nick. And it's like, no, dude, you didn't play really bad. He's just better than you.
It's interesting to be like that difference between the way some people will react when they get taken to school by Roger or Rafa or Novak versus the way they talk about it when they get taken to school by somebody who's not one of the greats to ever play the game. And, you know, where do they put the agency? Oh, you know, he was just too good today versus, oh, I didn't play very well. And how, like, the legend of players can impact the way they view the outcome. But anyways, I think that probably that's a lot for people to chew on. And there's probably going to be some of what we've said today that people don't agree with. And if you think that something we've said is crazy, we certainly would welcome you reaching out and telling us so. And you can do that how, Jacob?
Send me an email, jacob@tacticaltennis.com, and please tell me what I'm wrong about, because it's fun for me.
Yeah, you can email me at glenn@tacticaltennis.com.
You can talk over ourselves, and you can reach us on Twitter @tacticaltennis and on Instagram @tacticaltennis. And where are you, Glenn?
Well, on Twitter, you can reach me at Glenn S. Hill, so G-L-E-N-S-H-I-L-L. And also just check out the Facebook page. And I know we've said this before in virtually every other podcast in the last 10 or 15 or so, but if you haven't already, please rate the podcast on your favorite podcast app. And, you know, follow us on Facebook. We post some content there, you know, links not just to the podcast, but as articles come out. And also you go to the website, tacticaltennis.com, you can subscribe. And there'll be some more regular emails coming out soon with some content that you won't be able to get anywhere else as far as instructional stuff and tactics and whatnot. So I hope to hear from you folks. I hope you're enjoying the US Open, and we'll look forward to next time.
Cheers from the Open, guys.